A Map of the World, Disc 10.
On Friday, Sandy called to say that Mrs. Reisman was planning to make an offer of $300,000, a substantial cut in the asking price. I had figured what I would need to pay Rafferty, to retrieve Alice, to wrap up my considerable bank debt on land and machinery and livestock. I had also hoped to pay back my mother's loan. Mrs. Reisman's offer fell short.
"You can think about it," Sandy said. "You let it simmer and then give me a jingle."
I was standing at the window just the way I had when the girls were running through the sprinkler that morning near the start in June. Although now they were listless, sitting in front of the television, I could visualize them out in the yard, prancing around in their suits. "No," I said to Sandy, "it will do. I can live with it." I hung up. I announced, 43,000 minutes. We might actually be able to have Mom home in 43,000 minutes, Emma."
"Good,"
she said, without taking her eyes off the commercial. It was an advertisement for a doll that performed the bodily functions of a real baby. I took amphetamines in college, but that was nothing like the bug-eyed, empty-bellied rush I felt during those days when I systematically got rid of my farm. Soon after the offer was made, I called Dick Smeltz, the local auctioneer. He was the only person in Prairie Center besides Teresa who spoke to me that summer. When I told him I wanted to have the sale in 3 weeks, he said, "What's your hurry? You can't get it ready that fast." I said I was sure I could. I'd sell the herd, the tractors, the milking equipment, the hen house, the watering tanks, the baler, the combine, the fencing, the odds and ends. Hordes of people sensing desperation would come from miles around for a bargain.
"That's going to be tight, buddy," he said.
"Everything's tight," I said. There was only one person who might have understood my action. Teresa would take the sale personally and think I had overreacted. Rafferty was going to be livid. Dan didn't seem to care about much of anything. But had Alice been an outsider, I think she would have understood. She was extreme herself. If I'd been in a fiction, the sale would have made sense to her. She must have understood how a thing can be spoiled. If it hadn't been her property, she would see that my course, ditching the place, was reasonable. On the Thursday after we had all visited Alice, Emma was sick with a sore throat and a rash. I ended up taking her to a doctor in Blackwell's Satellite Clinic down in Silver Lake. She had scarlet fever. Claire was probably next in line. If I had made up the excuse of illness to avoid visiting Alice, it would have seemed flimsy, but our reason had the fortitude of truth. I wrote to her immediately, explaining that the girls needed to be isolated for a few days, that I would see her the following week. It was good to have a reprieve. The girls weren't uncomfortable once they got the antibiotic. They didn't have to suffer too much to accommodate my need to stay away from the jail. I would have liked to find a way not to visit the following week also. By that time, Mrs. Reisman had made her offer. If I didn't make the trip, Alice would know that something was awry. By the same token, if I did come, she would be shrewd enough to see some change in my face. There was danger, and I guess the risk made me bold. It was a challenge to keep her from knowing, to be self-possessed and sedate while my heart raged. I felt strapping and loud and fast, and to conceal my secret, I had to be quiet and slow and careful. I brazenly parked in the jail lot in a space reserved for a police vehicle. I locked the girls in the car with candy and crafts, leaving a crack in the window for air. Emma had charge of my old-fashioned watch. 20 minutes, I said to her. "When the hand gets to the 4, this is the only way. The only way." They were to stay in the car. They were not to roll down the window. They were to stay and keep still. They had learned that I was hard, that nothing would move me. I thought Alice might not show up when it was her pod's appointed time. I waited, watching the other inmates file past. She was the last one in line. She sidled up to her stool, slid on, and then picked up the phone. She didn't so much as glance at me. Her bruise had turned a pale yellow-green. She was wearing the pink bandana that made her look bald. "I'm mad," she said. "I know. Nobody tells me anything anymore."
"What do you mean?"
"Teresa hasn't written to me for weeks. What's that shit you said about her needing family time?"
She hadn't yet graced me with her all-knowing eyes.
"She suddenly stops taking care of Emma and Claire. She said it was so good for them. She went on and on about the healing process. Why do the girls think that they can only go play up there on Sunday afternoons?"
I did not correct her assumption that Teresa was caring for them while I visited the jail. "I think it's because of Dan," I said. "He's suffering over Lizzie." She nodded as if what I had said fully explained Teresa's change of heart. "What's happened to you, Alice?"
"When my hair grows out a little more, I'm going to look like Laurie Anderson. I try to imagine, for fun, that I'm on the last frontier, that this is the kind of place you go to prove yourself. There's got to be a little something here, a lesson, some kernel. At the very least, I should feel that I've been on some existential Conradian journey into darkness. And you having to cope with everything, the farm, the girls, the neighbors, while I'm learning some stupid moral. What happened?" I asked again.
"I bumped my head," she said. "I don't know, I had a concussion, and they even sent me to the hospital for a few days. It was a mess. I was really surprised they didn't call you, or Rafferty, for that matter."
"You bumped your head. That's all?"
She looked up then, as if the question was rude.
"Yeah," she said. She laughed, not as if it were funny. It was derisive, that ha-ha.
"This is getting long, Alice. It's going on too long." When I got back to the car, Emma was holding Claire in place in her seat. She had her pinned down. Claire was unable to move or make a sound. She was crying so hard her mouth was wide open all the way down to her uvula.
"She wanted to get out," Emma shouted. "I told her she couldn't. She was going to get out."
I yanked both of them by their collars and pulled them to the sidewalk.
"Where are we going?"
Emma cried.
"Walk. Just walk. Walk."
Emma ran ahead. When she was a safe distance, she turned and called,
"I don't ever want to go back home with you."
"That's a good attitude," I said. "You keep that attitude. You'll need it." In the weeks that followed, I got up early, as usual. I milked as quickly as I could. My cows were surprised by the way I slapped them around. They turned their heads to look back at me, their eyes wide, as if I was a stranger. I'd go into my study and make my list, and then study my list, learn it. I went from one task to the next, no longer thinking about Robbie's doll or Alice's bruise or Teresa's sweet voice. Although nothing was further from the truth, I told myself that everything was pretty well settled. Right after Mrs. Reisman made her offer, I went to the grocery store outside of Racine and found boxes. I told the girls we were going to pack up everything and then pretend we were hobos, living in freight trains, eating out of tin cans, singing all the day long, sharing one towel, living the carefree traveling life.
"You mean we'll make fires and roast wild animals and eat them with our bare hands?"
Emma asked. "Something like that."
"Will Mom come with us?"
"Sure."
"Yes!"
she cried. Of course, the girls had no idea how desultory it would be when the hay wagons were piled high with washtubs and boxes of nails, old mattresses, picture frames, the broken toys. I walked through the rooms, hearing the auctioneer call, "Here's a pretty little lampshade. Take the whole wagon, $50 for $1. What the fuck? Here's a lady with $60. We would leave with a few suitcases. I would take what I had, 2 pairs of jeans, 3 coveralls, a few shirts and sweatshirts, and a brand new suit, which would serve us well in court. There was not as much as I'd thought there'd be to disassembling the life we'd made. I must have had the idea that the job meant packing up the farm from its inception over 100 years before. I guess it seemed to me that I was dismantling the history of the place, taking it apart year by year. Considering the age of the homestead, there wasn't actually so much clutter. And we didn't own much. I realized through the process that we were transients with our few bags, moving on. We'd always been nothing more than transients, stopping by in a tumble-down house. I didn't let myself think about what the things up in the attic and in the outbuildings had meant, what their purpose was, who had handled them, who would next own them. I went from shed to shed, making piles of trash here and auction goods there. Emma and Claire knew they were to keep close, to stay clear of the pond and out of my way. They were getting to be resourceful. My girls were. They had thick black dirt under their fingernails and their hair was matted in the back. They watched TV until it made them sick and tired, and then they'd go out in the yard and pull a cat's tail and kick at each other. When they got that out of their systems, they settled down to make collections of stones and seeds, sticks and bird berries. They'd build up a city, make it perfect, and then fight about it and wreck it. At night, we fell dead asleep. In the morning, I woke up and again looked at my list. I dug in with such grim determination it might have been mistaken for zeal. One afternoon near the end of August, we drove to Spring Grove, a small town near Racine, a place where no one knew us. I had told the girls that we might stay in an apartment before we began the rambling life. We looked at a spot above a shoe store for $175 a month. It had a flea-bitten carpet and the stench of a long history of beer drinkers. There was an appealing cottage that would have been fine if it hadn't been right next to the sewage treatment plant. We went through a duplex, the low-income housing complex, and a group of condominiums along the river. We finally settled on a unit. It wasn't a home, it wasn't an apartment, it was a unit. It was a unit in a whole string of units. Together, the group of units was called Pheasant Glade. When we walked in the door, Emma, who had not said a word since lunch, sang out, "This is a nice one. This would be okay for us." Alice used to think that things which weren't at all amusing were, in fact, funny. That trait in her over the years had sometimes provoked me and driven me into a kind of quiet. But I was beginning to understand how something could be so astonishingly black you couldn't help laughing. Emma's easy pronouncement that the Pheasant Glade unit would do after living on 400 acres was so far from what was true that it was like slapstick. "I'll be able to ride my bike down the driveway," she said. "No gravel." Claire pointed to the corner where there was a station of metal mailboxes. She called triumphantly, "That is where Mom's letters will come." I wanted to be out before the closing so that when the cash came through, we'd already have made the break. We would go get Alice and hole up in Pheasant Glade waiting for what came next. I had not yet realized how pitiful our house was, until I tried to make a last-ditch attempt to care for it as I packed it away. I caulked around the shower and washed the windows. I tried to scrub the rust out of the toilets and the sinks. Sandy and Mrs. Reisman had not looked inside because the place was clearly in need of the wrecking ball. I had not prepared it for a viewing, and now, when it was doomed, I wanted to give it a last token of care. We hadn't ever had time to keep house. We had moved in when Emma was an infant. Alice had gone to school and found a job and then had Claire. I worked around the clock. Paint was peeling from the windowsills and the molding. We had never purchased curtains. In the bathroom, we had a worn towel that was held up by thumbtacks. We had long ago stopped seeing the rust, the holes in the linoleum, the cracks and water spots in the ceiling. We had grown used to having the spilled milk in the kitchen flow downhill into the bathroom. The house had given us a sense of history and belonging. I had always thought that it was benevolent, sheltering us, exerting a kind of love as we passed through. We had washed the walls when we first moved. That was all we had ever done for it. I was a meticulous packer for Alice. I put like things with like things. I labeled each box on four sides. Most of the games and toys were missing several pieces. The cane in two of the four chairs my mother had given us had been stood on so much the seats were about to give out. The sifter's handle was bent. The clocks didn't work. The wooden blocks were covered with scribbling. The magic markers were dried up. The sofa was filthy. The wing chair was ripped. The stereo was missing half the knobs. The books had been gnawed on by children or mice. Our junk didn't deserve my attention. I packed up the money box I had made out of oak for Emma on her fifth birthday. There was also a cherry wood bowl I'd made for Claire when she was born. Emma might someday give her money box to her son or daughter. He would have no way of knowing what the box meant to Emma, but he might like it. It was a good box, well made, with compartments in it for jewels, baseball cards, money, coins, dead animal specimens. It, a wooden box, might be the one good thing to survive me. I hauled down the trunk from the attic. "We're taking this," I said to the girls. "It goes with us." Inside were the farm relics, the stones, the lace, the books, the photographs. "That trunk is old and ugly," Emma said. She had inherited her mother's habit of quickly judging a thing. "It's supposed to be," I sniped. She recoiled. I didn't look, but I knew she was giving me the evil eye. I wrote to Alice every day, short notes reiterating my need to have her out of jail. Those letters seemed honest enough. I had told her half-truths along the way. I'd said that I couldn't find a babysitter, that Teresa needed family time. I mentioned that no one in town would serve us, speak to us, consider us among the living. Alice would have to understand that we couldn't send Emma to Blackwell Elementary for kindergarten. I laid the groundwork. I would tell her about the sale as late as possible, and when I felt like it, I'd inform Rafferty. It took about 2 weeks for Teresa to come down again. I let myself think about her for short periods of time. I'd give myself an image or the sound of her voice, and then let it go. I suppose I was fairly sure that she would weaken first. I could think about her, but taking the walk up to Vermont Acres, knocking on the door, was an impossible step. She came one afternoon when I was sitting on the floor looking over my old record albums by the boxed stereo. There was a rustle on the porch. I assumed it was the cats trying to get in. I was reading the song titles on the T for the Tillerman album. I was expecting the appraiser from Mrs. Reisman's bank. Before I could get up to see which it was, Mr. Phelps or Betty the Tabby, Teresa appeared in the arch between the kitchen and the living room. I guess she'd done the wrong thing with her hair because it was bushy. It was big and awful. The girls were behind me making beds for their dolls out of some of the smaller boxes. I didn't leap to my feet. I sat holding the album. She didn't look the way I remembered her. "It's true," she said. She wasn't out of breath. She wasn't smiling. "Teresa! Teresa!" Emma cried. "We're playing hobos. My dad says we're going to hop trains and eat rabbits raw." Teresa nodded, although I don't think she heard Emma. She looked at me, and lowering her voice, she said, "I've gotten a letter from her every day this week. She's terrified you're going to sell the farm. She mentioned the possibility to Rafferty, and he blew his circuits." "She always knows," I said. Teresa put one foot in front of the other and came that much closer. "Even though Rafferty got an extension, the trial is only two and a half months away. She's dealing with it. God knows how I'm going to explain that I haven't taken the girls. I haven't even made an attempt." "I'm not going to explain," I snapped. "Are you okay?" She came into the room and stood over me. Her eyes welled up with tears. "Look," I said, "we can't stay here anymore. It's so obvious, I don't know why I have to explain to you or to her. People don't recover from this kind of charge. We'll have to sell, even if she's acquitted. I think Alice is concentrating on surviving, and she hasn't taken into consideration the fact that we're finished here. It's over." I started past Teresa into the kitchen. I turned, took her hand, kissed it. She stepped away and put both her hands behind her back. I shrugged and sat down. Alice used to be so worried about certain people talking about her, I said. She used to think that old ladies were going to blab about her. I used to tell her to cut it out, that it was senseless to pay attention to rumor mongers. Now I see what there is to be afraid of. Talk. That's it. Talk. And I don't know why we ever thought we could farm here. A person needs community. I call up to Madison every time I think of doing something different. I want to ridge till or start rotational grazing. I have to call a bloody academic. If we wanted to build a barn, there'd be nobody to come for the raising. What am I talking about anyway? There isn't any such thing anymore, a barn. It would be a pole shed, not a wooden post and beam beauty. In Iowa, all the farms are owned by about 5 corporations. There's no future in the family farm. None. All the farmers were moving out of here just about the time we arrived. To this town, we're some city people who stepped in where we don't belong. I used to think there were rules of nature, strict rules. If you broke them, you'd pay. But of course, nature doesn't give a damn about anything. It's our own codes that are arbitrary, merciless. What's wrong with us that we don't want a ranch house with a big round metal pool in the yard? Nobody cares that this ground means something to me, that I get satisfaction knowing that below our garden there used to be a path that the Teamsters used. They brought their supplies into Prairie Junction with their wagons and oxen. You go out there and squint and you can just about see those fucking oxen. If it means so much to you, then you should stay, she said. She was leaning over the table, about to take hold of my shoulder. Before she reached, she thought better of it. People have short memories. This will look like you're running. Rafferty says, I don't care what Rafferty says. Do you understand? I don't care what he says. I was shouting in her face. You have a right to be here, she said softly. Claire distracted us by running into the kitchen and grabbing Teresa's leg. Is it time to go to your house? No, I said. Claire, who had always been so even-tempered, sat down on the floor and proceeded to bang her head against the cabinet. Oh, sweetie, Teresa crooned, kneeling down and putting her arms around her. It's all right. I want to go to your house, Claire sobbed. It's cold there. Let's walk down to the pond, Teresa said, looking up at me, but talking still to Claire. You and Emma can play in the sand and wade. I can see you need to cool off. Isn't that a good idea? No, I don't think so, I said. Look at your girls, she commanded. They are hot and uncomfortable. Claire has prickly heat on her neck and down her back. She's dirty, Howard. The pond shouldn't be shut up like someone's ghostly bedroom. There's no sense in the girls thinking it's a bad place. There's just no sense in that. I started to say that it was August already and that we'd used the pond every day to survive the heat. She was herding my children out the door, patting their heads, telling them she'd missed them. How many times, I wondered, had we, Alice and I, and Emma and Claire, walked the lane in the middle of a summer afternoon? We had thought of the pond as our perk. We didn't have jobs that offered health insurance or a lunch tab, a company car, box seats at the sports arena. We had slow time on July days. Hot and sleepy, we used to make our way to the water's edge. In that hour or two, there never seemed to be anything to hurry for. I used to trick myself into thinking there wasn't a mountain of work waiting for me at all points beyond the clearing. Teresa stood, looking at the water while the girls ran to get the buckets we kept stashed in the hollow of a log. They peeled off their clothes down to their underpants. I buckled them into their life jackets. I made them wear the jackets, in spite of the fact that they both knew how to swim. It was ridiculous because they couldn't go underwater very well with the vests on. This is where she is for me, Teresa said. I could never explain to Dan that the pond isn't sinister. It's just water. My heart hurts like wild every time I come up from the woods. You know everything, that I feel like I'm going to die with the hurt. But I'm drawn here, too. I have to come. And I believe, Howard, that the place needs to be peopled. I have the feeling she is here and that life needs to go on in this setting so she won't get lonely, so she'll be a part of us. We sat on two rusty metal chairs that had been down at the pond for probably a good 30 years. I knew I should do something to stop whatever she was going to say next. I was leaving Prairie Center. We were going. I should thank her for Sandy Brickman and Mrs. Reisman. She had done a brilliant job sending down those two women to rescue me. She had also marched into police headquarters and told the investigators to lay off Alice. Thank you should have wrapped it up. I braced myself when she took a deep breath. Howard, she said my name as if it were an imported chocolate. The sound of it made me cringe. At first, she said, I told myself that that night wasn't important, that it didn't matter. Yep, I mouthed, trying to concur. No, actually, at first I was scared to death that I'd broken a commandment. Thou shalt not covet anything that is thy neighbor's. It was the words that horrified me. Isn't that the limit? I'm a good Catholic girl at heart, and I guess I always will be. After I'd gotten over the fright of the individual sentences, I kept thinking of that night as a mistake. But I just can't believe it anymore. It was spiritual for both of us. I know it was. The impulse was one of love, of purity. It was a rare sort of intimacy, rare. She nodded, agreeing with herself. I'm not going to say any more about it. I believe what I just said, and I always will. She was staring at my profile. I could feel her eyes on me while I watched the girls frolicking in a place that seemed polluted. I'm sorry that I haven't come down, haven't taken Emma and Claire. I felt so mixed up for a while, I just didn't think I could see you. Dan came home from his conference the next night. I screamed right away the second he walked in the door that either he had to talk to me or I would leave him. We had a fight. He accused me of breaking down everywhere I go, and I yelled at him about how he is in denial, the likes of which I have never seen in all my professional days, and that one of these mornings he was going to wake up and realize his heart was broken in spite of himself, that that was going to be far worse than knowing you have a broken heart and tending your hurt. I told him we wouldn't tiptoe around him anymore, that we weren't going to pretend we were fine. I said I cried to everyone else because I was scared out of my wits to even say her name, to say Lizzie in front of him. I've been afraid that I'll make one slip and he'll break. You know that. I said it killed me to see him suffering. It hurt so much to begin with, and then with his pain on top of it. I feel sometimes like I'm carrying everyone's pain. That's why I've had to go bawling around. She was so close to my face I could smell her. My God, she said. He nearly cracked up at the kitchen table. About all he let me do is keep a hold of his arm. Finally, he started to talk about it. He said he couldn't stand Lizzie being only a memory. He said he just hadn't gotten enough of her, that he hardly knew her. He has been trying to find some way he can carry her presence forward, trying to connect her with our life now. He hates the photographs because they are so flat and still. With you, she murmured. With you, there was all that sorrow, you know? We were going to leave Prairie Center. We'd be gone as soon as I could settle the lease for the unit. With Dan, there is so much anger. He's still furious with me because I let the girls come down here that day. And, of course, that makes me secretly fume, because when did he ever have to arrange for childcare? He gets himself out of bed and goes to work every day, never even has to think about making time for himself or planning around the family. There's no point in bringing all that up. Who cares about it anymore? But you see, he's not reasonable. He's mad because I got my tubes tied. I got the ligation after Lizzie was born. I mean, we had both decided two was enough. Well, anyway, it was one of those... What do you call them? What? I'm going senile. You know, one of those cathartic experiences. I have one more cathartic experience that'll probably do me in. We screamed and cried. The next morning, he stayed around for a while, though, and we, all of us, talked about Lizzie. I sat down at breakfast and said, "Remember how Lizzie called the neighbor's dog Mutt-wee?" Audrey looked terror-stricken. And then when Dan started to laugh and say how funny that was, I could see her breathing this tremendous sigh of relief. She was looking out at the pond now, at the girls instead of at me. After he left for work, I said to myself, "Howard means nothing to me. It was a fluke, a dream." I thought of calling my old friend Father Albert and confessing. I'm not sure exactly what I would have confessed, but he always tells me at least one thing that changes my life. He'd probably tell me, too, that it was time I turned my thoughts homeward, to draw close to Dan and Audrey. I was pretty sure that you would have woken up and felt as strange as I did. "Right," I said. But as the day wore on, I kept thinking about you. "Damn you," she whispered, laughing out at the water. "So, all right. All right. A week, 2 weeks have passed. I see you everywhere I go. I see you out the kitchen window. I see you in my closet. I see you in the glass of the coffee table. I dream that I'm riding up and down elevators trying to find you. I love you. You know that?" She turned back to look at my profile. "It doesn't matter in our day-to-day life, I know. Maybe it's the displacement of the love I have for Lizzie. Maybe I'm giving that to you. It doesn't matter because there's nothing to be done. It's just one of those things I want to shout from the rooftops." I continued to watch the girls' every move. "So I love you, Howard," she said again. "You are a good person. You are everything that's good." I rolled my eyes and snarled. I was about to say that was the sort of crap 16-year-olds drool into each other's ears. I made the mistake of looking at her. Her face was pink, bright. I think it was the hope in her expression, in her half-smile that momentarily chastened me. "No, I'm not," I shook my head. And then I thought of something that might be true. "When I was a kid," I said, "I used to think that bravery involved action. It took courage, I figured, to move forward, to pursue a dream, to get ahead in the world, just to get where you were supposed to. I thought having desire took courage. Now I realize that none of that requires bravery. The only thing you really need bravery for is standing still or standing by." I put my hand on her cheek. She closed her eyes and gasped a little, leaning into my fingers. She was making her cheek as if to hold my hand. I didn't feel as if I had the strength to stand up, to walk back to the house, to wait and wait for Alice to get out. To wait and wait through the years in some strange town with my daughters and my wife. Chapter 16. The transaction with Mrs. Reisman was not complete until the middle of September. The land had to be surveyed and assessed by the bank. The water had to be tested. The Boy Scout officials and their legal counsel had to give their approval. They came out twice to inspect their future camp. Arnold L. Reisman III visited several times in his Eddie Bauer outdoorsman costume to walk the property. He confided that his mother knew what she wanted within 5 minutes of laying her eye on a thing and that it was his job to do the delving. They'd looked at quite a few properties, he said, most of them farther away from the city, in crowded lake communities or in distant tracts of dense woods that offered little more than ticks or mosquitoes. His mother had a knack for spotting quality, and although she was usually right about her decisions, there were exceptions. Take the row houses on the east side of Milwaukee, for instance, that she was just about to sign on when he discovered radon so thick in the basement the air was yellow. I didn't talk much beyond pointing out the interesting geological features of our farm. I didn't say that radon is invisible. The exertion of walking under the summer sun in pants and hiking shoes brought color into Arnold's pallid face and left him panting. He had a clean handkerchief in his pocket to wipe the fine beads of sweat from his brow. He conceded that the farm was an excellent property. He was going to get a lot of enjoyment out of it once he hacked some trails here and there. I wondered how long the land would sustain his interest before he was off on one of his exotic fishing vacations. I had once, in a moment of sentiment, almost told him about the teamsters, about the fellow who built the house, the boy who fell off the hay wagon. I half wanted to show him the abstract and the journal. In the next instant, I thought about the trunk. I realized then that those things in the trunk belonged to the farm and that it was only right to leave them for Arnold to discover. He could go down for coffee at Dell's and get the whole story. I would leave everything to chance, to what in my younger days I'd thought of as the guiding hand of chance. Perhaps if Arnold was subject to whimsy, if he was a closet sap, the relics would tickle his fancy. The objects in the trunk, after all, and the trunk itself, were not much without the associations, the barn, the fields, the hint of wagon wheel ruts that a person could still make out if they wanted to enough. The trunk was like a fish out of water by itself, something that was dead. I'd mentioned to Arnold that I had burned out milking cows, that I couldn't make enough at it, not with milk price supports what they were. I lied and said I was going to take it easy for a while before I looked for gainful employment. On the final visit, he thrust his bony hand into mine and said with the heartiness and sincerity of a good Eagle Scout, "Well, best of luck to you." "Same to you," I said. In my negotiations with Mrs. Reisman, she had agreed to let me use the chicken shed for storage through Christmas. I hauled some of the furniture that was not going to fit in the apartment down there. We might someday want the old dining room hutch, the extra bedsteads, the mahogany chest of drawers, and the kitchen table. Although the table was as much a part of the house as the trunk, I knew the Reismans would sell it or have the help hack it up for firewood. I could justify taking it along. The fact is, I needed it. I thought of it as having an eye. It had seen the Indians up in the township of Winston. It had been witness to countless disasters and fewer triumphs. Its virtue lay in its inability to speak. On the morning of the auction, September 5th, we escaped to Spring Grove and set up house in the apartment. There were fair skies across the state. I guess it's accurate to say that I had been in a frenzy as the sale got closer. I'd packed up in boxes everything we wanted to keep and organized the rest into categories on the lawn. If it had rained that Saturday, it would have been the last bad joke of the summer. Dick Smeltz, the auctioneer, had come over twice to help me. I'd spoken to very few adults since the end of June. I kept talking to myself, out of habit, even while he was at my side. He looked over our possessions and wrote down figures on his clipboard. He remembered some of the things that were back again on the hay wagons that had not sold when the former owners had had their auction. I had gone at my tasks methodically and in high gear during those last weeks. The cows and the girls felt my anxiety. Near the end, I did not unwind enough to fall asleep. I trained Emma to answer the phone, to ask, "Who's calling, please?" I told her she was my secretary, and I paid her a nickel a day. If it was Rafferty, she was to tell him I was out working. I kept going over the auction items in my mind. I lay in bed picturing our things, one by one, as if before me all night long was a great TV auction. I had little doubt that most of it would sell. Smeltz knew of two potential buyers for the herd. Each of the parties had come beforehand to look over my Guernseys. When I went out that last morning to milk, I didn't let myself slow down once. I didn't walk around the barn or loiter to admire the weather vane. It was just as well that there hadn't been enough of a hay crop to fill the silo. I didn't speak to the cows as I milked. I kept right on going when I was finished, out the barn door, into the house, up the stairs to wake the girls, down the stairs with our bags, standing up to eat breakfast, and out the front door. Hello to Dick as he arrived, into the Ford. We buckled up and drove off. I think the girls had settled into a perpetual state of shock. They didn't know what was happening to us. They didn't know either what question to ask that would make me explain the upheaval. I'd packed their beds the day before, but I didn't tell them as we drove off that we weren't coming back to stay. They were often quiet and, I think, scared. We would go back and forth to the farm over the coming weeks, but we didn't ever sleep there again. Everything in our unit in Pheasant Glade, the carpets, the cabinets, the walls, the doors, the bathtub, the toilets, the faucets, the doorbell, the molding, the shades, the light fixtures, everything down to the carpet tacks was brand new. I couldn't get used to that. The whole townhouse had the fresh, toxic smell of new vinyl. The living room had the all-important cathedral ceiling, a stone fireplace with a small glass door and a grating that barely held one log. The floor was covered with blue and gray speckled wall-to-wall carpet. The living room opened into a galley kitchen and breakfast nook. The breakfast nook looked out to a wooden deck that had just enough space for a Weber and a porch chair. Upstairs there were two bedrooms, including the master suite with sliding doors and a deck that faced the highway. There was a bath with a whirlpool tub that was just big enough for two very young children. The whole place was deceptive. Here, it seemed to squeak and stink, is the American dream. Except that everything we were supposed to want, everything that looked so good, was too small or too flimsy to use. I realized as I dragged in our few old scratched pieces of furniture that even the shabby rooms above the shoe store would have been better than the false cheer of Pheasant Glade. We did have our own garage and a basement with a laundry room. There was no yard beyond the short deck. The girls sat on the driveway and watched me lug in their beds and the chairs from the U-Haul I'd rented. I managed to move the piano single-handedly with a lot of cursing. Both Claire and Emma seemed to sense right off in the second viewing that what they had given up was in no way compensated for by an asphalt driveway and a 6x8 wooden deck, a whirlpool bath, and shag carpet. I didn't answer Claire when she asked, "We're not really going to live here, are we?" One of the tacky cupboards fell off the wall, right to the floor. I hadn't done anything more violent than put a glass on the shelf. As it smashed, I wished for Teresa. She would have taken the girls from room to room and made the cheap, ugly things seem interesting. She would have feigned excitement over the public library down the block and the A&W beyond the second line of units. She would have encouraged us to go out for breakfast routinely and feed on egg and bacon biscuits. I would have very little money by the time we were through. The bulk of my sudden wealth was going to clean up my debt to the bank as well as purchase Rafferty's supposed decency and skill. I hadn't spent enough time to work out all the numbers. We could keep body and soul together for a few months before we scratched our messages on our signs and went out to the highway. For dinner that first night in Spring Grove, we had a ground beef and cheese casserole that Teresa had made. She'd left it on our doorstep in a cooler at the farm sometime after dawn. As we were eating in our new kitchen, Emma looked at me and said, "If Mom can't ever come home, do you think we could live with Teresa? Could she be like a grandma?" "I want Mama," Claire protested. "But, I mean, if she couldn't ever come home, ever, ever, could we go live with Teresa for part of the time so we could be with a lady?" My daughters were guileless. Out our window, past the deck, you could rest your gaze on the dumpsters. I'm sure all of us were thinking about what it would be like to come downstairs in the morning in that house in Vermont Acres. We'd come down to the kitchen where there'd be so much love in the air it would be visible. Yellow, thick, probably exactly how radon looks. When Alice came to her visiting station the last Sunday she was in jail, she studied me before she picked up the phone. I waited for the conversation to begin with the receiver at my ear. She was wearing the pink bandana on her head. Her face had grown longer, thinner in jail, her blue eyes larger. I didn't think I looked any particular way, but after a minute she grabbed the phone and said, "Don't tell me you sold the farm. Just don't tell me that. I haven't had a letter from Teresa in ages or one from you all week, and it makes me nervous as hell. Rafferty's even been wondering about you. He says he leaves messages and you don't call him back. There's no law that says Emma has to go to kindergarten. We could teach her ourselves. The farm is the first place I ever felt safe and alive and, oh Christ, real and at home. Did I ever tell you that?" "I sold the farm," I said, as calm as my usual old self. "I'll tell Rafferty when I'm ready. I thought you would want to know." She surprised me by crying. "The auction was yesterday," I continued. "A farmer from New Derry took the cows. He took the pop-up baler, too." The tears were streaming down her face and splashing on the countertop. I wouldn't torture her further. No need to mention how little some of our fine equipment had brought. "I sold it, Alice," I said, "because I want to get you out of here, more than anything." There were elements of truth there. "I sold it because our life in Prairie Center is over. We'll be guilty even if we're proven innocent. That's what Rafferty doesn't understand. As soon as we close, we'll come and get you." She got up to tell the guard that she was finished. I swore, watching her go, that I wasn't going to come to the visiting room one more time. I swore I wasn't going to leave the girls out in the parking lot again. We'd start up our life fresh once Alice was out, back along the straight and narrow. If she was proven guilty, we'd try to keep to our rigid path. We'd try to go slowly, creeping, so that after she'd served her term, she'd run only a short distance to catch us.
"Is this what you meant by being a hobo?" Emma asked after a few days in Spring Grove.
It was no use drawing the ever-receding future. I didn't know if our fortunes would improve, if I could find a job, if the trial would come out in our favor. If Alice was acquitted, then we would take to the road. We could go to Alaska, South Dakota, Australia. We could move to California, where I could set up a dairy shrine west to honor the dairy industry that had helped to drain the Colorado aquifer of her water.
"It isn't exactly what I meant, Emma," I said.
We closed in the late afternoon of the third Friday in September. It seemed fitting that we had to go 70 miles all the way to Milwaukee to the 26th floor of a fancy downtown office building to give our farm away. The girls had gotten used to tagging along, waiting in reception areas with candy and some new cheap thing, a little doll, a puzzle, beads to thread. They didn't get too excited over treats anymore. While I was signing the papers in the inner sanctum, they got into a brawl in the lobby. I could hear Claire's blood-curdling scream down the hall. I excused myself. There was nothing to threaten them with because they'd already lost everything. They also didn't seem to care if I hurt them. The receptionist saved the day by showing them how her fax machine worked. I took my leave to finish giving over the farm to Mrs. Reisman. When Sandy shook my hand for the last time, she said, "I sure hope that operation goes according to plan."
"What operation?" I said.
"Your sister, the bone marrow treatment."
"She died," I said, giving her hand a final squeeze. Through the summer, there had been occasional respites from the heat, as well as a few insignificant rainy spells. The night we closed, rain poured down, and cool air moved in from the east. By Saturday morning, the crickets had come back to life to sing their farewell song. Some of the maples had turned color prematurely and were beginning to shed their leaves.
Families were raking together and burning trash when we drove to the bank in Spring Grove. Smoke was rolling across the streets. We were going to get our certified check for $100,000 and then head for Racine. It was Emma who suggested we find some flowers for Alice that we decorate the unit. Before the bank opened, we went along the road out of town and picked a few straggling clumps of chicory and Queen Anne's lace. We harbored our fears as we drove to get her. Emma fretted that the money wouldn't be enough, that the rules might have changed. Claire wondered if Alice would remember us. Emma called her sister an idiot and insisted that they would never be forgotten. I had plenty of my own worries. I once thought that memory was naturally coupled with understanding, with perspective. I have found that not to be the case. Despite the distance, I can't say now I have a clear sense of what happened last summer. I don't know either if you can compare one thing to another, if a specific thing is actually like any other thing. The summer had been a test of some sort. I suppose it was a test of faith. If that was so, I had failed. But I also wasn't sure that there would have been any way to win, if it would have been better to look with blind eyes, to be faithful to the ideal. It wasn't apparent that one way was better than the other. To doubt was not a deadly sin, but it seemed to be as poisonous as any of the seven. Doubt had undermined all that I had taken for granted. I hated the fact that I would never really know what was true. There were reasons not to believe either side. There is no point in fixing the summer in my mind, settling upon a half-truth to satisfy my need to know. It still seems to me now that it is better to be vigilant, to keep those months fluid, never firming up the story, never calling any one person a defining name. It is better, I think, never to finally decide. In a weak moment, I once tried to ask Alice, to tell her that I wasn't sure. She stopped me. It is probably for the best that I didn't give voice to my gravest doubt. Because I tell myself that I don't know and will never know, I can almost fool myself at times. I can almost talk myself into believing that last summer didn't take place. We waited in the entry of the jail while Alice was notified. When the guard let her through, she rushed at the girls. I gathered up the things that she dropped on the floor. After a few minutes, I made them move to the door. I pushed them out of the stuffy entry, out of that place. Alice knelt at the curb, and they alternately held close to her and pulled away to stroke her bandana, her face, her chest. They touched her shyly, as if she was a wounded animal. She didn't say much. Emma was quiet, but Claire fired questions at her, one after the next, without waiting for an answer.
Did you miss us? Did you have good food to eat? Was it like a restaurant? Will you have to go back there ever again? Dad got me a skipper. Why are you wearing that hat?
After a while, I helped her up. It was starting to rain again. She lifted her face to the sky for a minute and opened her mouth. We walked across the parking lot to the street. She carried Claire in her left arm and held Emma by the hand. As we passed the Presbyterian church, the carillons began to chime, a warped rendition of For the Beauty of the Earth. Each note was in tune as it was played and then went flat as the next one rang out. There were people in their Sunday best waiting in lines on the steps. Emma announced that it was a wedding. Somehow she knew without being told.
The bride is going to come so everyone can see her dress, she said in awed tones.
We kept walking. Emma pulled at Alice's hand to slow her down. I wanted to leave Racine. I wouldn't have stopped for anything. When they caught up with me on Grand Street, Alice spoke at last.
The bride had some teeth missing, she said.
Maybe she'll be covered by her new husband's dental plan. Maybe she'll be able to get them fixed. She seemed happy at the prospect of the strange girl getting a bridge and a few crowns. I guess I laughed in disbelief at her pleasure. "Maybe she will, Alice," I said. The sky opened then, and rain began to pour down, fresh, cool rain falling in sheets. We walked on without worrying. The girls danced at our sides. We didn't quicken our pace or try to cover up. The water struck our heads and flattened our hair and poured down our necks. When we got to the car, we were drenched and cold. I turned on the heater full blast. There was a fire engine parked up the block, its revolving light showing red through the rain. It pulled out into traffic right before we did. Emma and Claire didn't seem to notice or care about the general splendor of the equipment. It was in front of us until we reached the outskirts of Racine. The fire trucks used to drive through the streets after a fire when I was a kid, ringing their bells to let everyone know that all was well. It was too bad they didn't do that anymore. There used to be a collective sigh of relief when those trucks came past our houses on the way to the station. I wondered if the firemen in front of us were history buffs, like me. Maybe they kept a metal bell in the truck, a relic from the old days, now with a few cracks along the side and a broken clapper. I turned around to look at Alice. She was holding both girls in her lap in the back seat. She was resting her head against them, breathing heavily, as if their dirty hair and clothes and the forced air of the heater was fresh. Claire was sucking her own thumb, and Emma was running her finger along the frayed edge of Alice's shorts. I could almost hear the ring of celebration and homecoming from the fire engine in front of us. The ring of that bell's damaged clang.
Alice. Chapter 17. When I was out on bail, Teresa, in her eternal optimism and breathless wonder, pronounced that I had learned to embrace fear. "Embrace?" I asked, laughing. "No, I don't think so," I said. "Not embrace. Nothing nearly as active as embrace." "No," I said again. "Not embrace." But while I was away, I did learn again to be quiet and wait. There were days when I felt little different in jail than I had when I was 9 years old, up in my bedroom at home, with the tray of colored pencils and the sheaf of papers at my side, at work on my map of the world. All those years ago, I used to curl up, secure in my own country, an old stoic in a young body, sure that if I feigned indifference out beyond my bedroom door, I wouldn't be hurt. How many times had I advised Emma to ignore a taunt or an injury, knowing full well that the slightest insult to a 5-year-old stings like salt in a wound? I remembered what resolve I'd had after my mother's death, to remove myself to the tropical climate suggested by the green-colored pencil on my map. I was alone, and yet never lonesome, in a place I think now must have been distinguished from Earth by an atmosphere made up of new elements, elements to breathe which filled the inhabitants with a sense of safety. I remembered having had such acute and chronic stomach aches through adolescence that my Aunt Kay finally took me to the doctor to see if I had an ulcer. It was all in my head, Dr. Finnegan concluded after the exam. My father, irritated because my infirmity couldn't be resolved by surgery or medication, ordered me to be more sociable and then withdrew to his study. As I got older, I wondered how to get into the race while at the same time preserving what I thought of as my soul. I was moved to tears reading the ancient philosophers in my ethics class my freshman year in college. I understood that I had spent my entire young life standing guard, as if my body were a great walled fortress around the small thing, as fragile as a twig on its velvet pillow. My soul. It was a delicate, impossible balance. To see, to touch, to feel, and yet to have nothing penetrate to the inner realm, so as not to twist or crack or break the poor twig. At 18, I was studious and quiet, staking out a carol in the library and reading day after day until the light outdoors faded and my reflection stared back at me in the window. I'd fold my arms around my head and sleep sitting up, thinking as I drifted off, that I could feel my pith growing stronger even without the aids of strangers and lovers. I would occasionally find myself out on cold, starry nights, right by the railroad tracks, standing close to the trains as they streaked past. I wanted the cold to pierce me, wanted to feel the tremor of the earth under the train, wanted to stay awake in the snow until every part of me was aching with fatigue, and all so I'd know I was alive. Years later, with several experiments in sociability under my belt, Howard had come to me like some exotic remedy, that rare extract calibrated to produce sensation without harm. Sometimes I couldn't think exactly why I was in jail. I'd lose track of the reason. I was locked away, I'd think, to test my liberal upbringing, to measure just how deep my muddled convictions went. When I was in high school, Aunt Kate used to read aloud from her holy books, from E.M. Forster's novels, over our oatmeal and stewed prunes. Where Aunt Kate professed that despite our differences, we are one, my father meant me to understand that other people, not our sort, are the ones who starve, who suffer indignities. I don't think I'll ever be able to see a piece of playground equipment rising up from the cement at the park or the zoo without my heart convulsing at speeds that are not recommended on exercise pulse charts. In our living unit at the jail, there were two steel tables that had been cast into concrete and looked to be growing out of the floor. While I was locked up, I cleaned my plate and changed one pair of tube socks for another without having tremors. When I was out, I couldn't abide the sight or smell of American cheese between two pieces of soft white bread, scalloped potatoes, fried chicken, tater tots, fruit cocktail, and canned peas. I bought expensive cotton socks with textured flowers and bold colors. Emma asked me repeatedly what the jail was like. Should I compare it to a day at the babysitter's, I wondered? Or to the cow comfort stalls Howard had built for the Guernseys with staggering results in milk output? In their new quarters, the cows had remained cleaner and spent 2 more hours a day lying down and ruminating. In jail, I had been leagues away from the air and the sky, so perhaps it was like spending months near the ocean floor in a submarine. It was like being one of a large litter of hamsters in a small metal cage, Emma, I said at last. Really? She looked out the window for a while, surely imagining living flat up against everyone else's wet, hairless skin. No privacy for the most basic, the most intimate functions. Finally, she turned to me and said, "You mean you had one of those wheels to run on?" "What's so funny?" Howard said, coming into the living room where I was huddled into the sofa, clutching my stomach. Before I could explain, Emma said sternly, "It's a joke I have with Mom." He raised his eyebrows and backed off. "Wouldn't ever want to get between a private joke." She came to me and whispered in my ear, "Did you have a water tube and the green pellets to eat and sawdust on the floor?" To gratify her, to keep her beside me, I spun out my laughter, trying to keep it even and continuous, relishing our first little confidence. I had wittingly hid from the terrors of the world in the bosom of our farm. I had been grateful not to worry about crossfire on my way to the grocery store. Grateful about not having to lock our doors. Grateful there weren't yet signs of gang activity in the high school. I had known that a person's place in society was precarious, that an ill wind could push you across to the other, the wrong side. Teresa carried on at length in her letters about how difficult it must be for someone such as I to deal with the horrors of jail. She meant well, I know. And while jail is a shock to a middle-class person, more so than for the drug dealers and prostitutes who regularly come in off the street, I came to think that for the common good, everyone should spend a little time reduced to a hamster, that incarceration should be mandatory, like jury duty. Linnell, a prisoner who was dying from AIDS, said, "Being cooped up make a person feel, I don't know, real church-like after a while. Your big old body ain't nothing but shit, so it make you think about whatever else is kicking around. I sees visions, I hears words, and then, when you gets out, don't the air smell good? Damn, even the cold smell good." Howard, like Emma, curious about places he'd never been, at first seemed to have an urgent need to know all about my experience. I understood that he wanted to relieve me of the burden of it, to feel as if he had somehow shared in my misery. I think he must have thought I was bent on denying him the opportunity, that I was holding my trials close to my chest as I made my way to martyrdom. For the longest time, I couldn't speak of what it had been like to be locked away, partly because it was only afterward that I registered fear. I'd start thinking back and break out into a sweat. I sensed that what he really wanted was a neat package, a summary which concluded with the assertion that I was well. It wasn't as simple as telling the family a narrative about a trip downtown. Jail is one of the last holdouts on Earth, a place where there is still an oral tradition. Sometimes I think the inmates made trouble not only so there'd be a story to tell, but so there'd be 5 stories to tell, each rendition becoming funnier or more grotesque or outlandish. There were stories to tell, certainly. But there were also stories to tell about the telling of the stories. Although I long ago lost faith in the idea of truth, I knew that once I spoke, the stories would take on their own shape, their own truth. In my darkest hour, I doubted that there was even a lesson to take from that rubble of time. But whatever the moral was, I knew I needed to fashion the pieces together and to myself before all of it came tumbling out, the essence drifting heavenward, gone before I understood what it was. Plenty had been recorded about the violence, the foulness, the utter uselessness of jail life. A great deal more will be said as the years wear on, with the present trend of sentencing criminals without the opportunity for parole. The Racine Jail was a relatively mild place, and I should count myself lucky that I wasn't part of a larger, poorer system. It's marvelous how few details there are in jail. It's a feat that in a world so various, men can pare a place down to hard steel and dull, ungiving concrete, a few thin blue blankets. The grease ant has more color and variation than did our pod on the 4th floor. Everyone wore the same day-glow orange shirts and pants. Everyone ate the same food and had the same space under the unrelenting sameness of the fluorescent lights. It was the small things I sometimes let myself mourn for. Sunshine, shadow, the dark of a country night, the thick, hot air of summer. We could never get away from our own smell, or anyone else's smell, or the noise of the television, or the noise of angry talk. so that after a short time we began to hold like fury to ourselves, because our very distinctness seemed endangered. In that struggle, some of us took ourselves to extremes. We became caricatures, shrill and distorted. I had felt from the first mention of Robbie Mackesy that the mess was so much bigger than all of us put together. Not long after my arrest, I woke up knowing that I couldn't fight. It wasn't that I didn't have the strength. Howard, white with fear, tried to feed my anger so that I'd be fighting mad. I couldn't explain to him that it was beyond fighting, beyond requiring strength. He thought I had given up, but that wasn't right. The die was cast. That's what I knew. It wasn't a matter of hoping or praying, or even deliberately working hard in order that justice could prevail. Because already each of us, Howard and I, Emma and Claire, had lost so much. I came to know that Robbie would suffer most from the process. It was he, more than anyone else, who gave me the face of resignation. I didn't want to lose the case, and yet winning would be a somber victory, no grounds for rejoicing. I told Rafferty that I thought the stocks were a good idea after all, that I wouldn't have minded people coming and hurling things at me for a limited time. Howard, in many of his history lessons, had once told me that in the American colonies women used to be punished if they were considered common scolds. Surely that was my crime. I could have easily granted anyone who wanted a few pitches of a tomato, a rotten egg, a small pebble below the waist. Everyone would feel better, and then we could go home.
This ends Disc 10.